Welcome to Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. In this series, we're talking curriculum. We'll be exploring the intersection of climate change and health through illustrative patient cases developed by climate health experts and sitting down with educators around the world to learn how they've enacted climate-focused curricular change. I'm Elizabeth Whitten.
And I'm Phoebe Cunningham. We're medical students at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, and we'll be your new co-hosts of Code Green for the upcoming season. This is a bittersweet episode because our wonderful host for the past year, Jenny Silva, is leaving the podcast as she graduates medical school this spring. We have greatly benefited from Jenny's leadership as her classmates over the years, and we're sad to see her go, but are very excited to be joining the podcast.
In this episode, we're going to discuss the connection between anxiety and climate change. To guide our discussion, we'll be talking to Dr. Carissa Klarich, Dr. Jennifer Robohm, and Dr. Robin Cooper, who are the co-authors of a case on this topic from the Climate Resources for Health Education Initiative. Another one of the primary authors, Kayla Morrissey, could not be here with us today. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. Before we dive in, just to frame this discussion for listeners a bit, we would love to hear about what inspired you to write this case, how you focus on this dimension of the climate health nexus for your case topic, and what each of your roles were in crafting this case.
Hi, my name's Jen Robohm. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist on faculty with the Family Medicine Residency of Western Montana. I've been working for several years to integrate climate change into our curriculum, and working on a case for the CRHE initiative just seemed like a great place to contribute.
Hi, I'm Carissa Klarich. I'm a second-year psychiatry resident at the University of Nevada Psychiatry Residency. I'm interested in specializing in reproductive psychiatry, but prior to residency, since I was going into psychiatry, I had an interest in delving into an anxiety case, and my interest in climate change started prior to my career change to medicine, where I was working in the built environment and being exposed to how the built environment could impact climate. So it was a good marriage of those two interests.
Hi, I'm Robin Cooper. I'm delighted to be here. I am the clinical associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. But my specialty is in the work about climate change and mental health. And my work there has led me to be co-founder and president of Climate Psychiatry Alliance, which is a national group of psychiatrists and mental health professionals who are committed and devoted to education and advocacy about the issues that relate to the mental health impacts of climate change, a subdivision of the health impacts. So I have been very concerned about how medical education and residency education incorporates the issues of health due to climate change. And I think that there's a profound lack in attention to this in what is now one of the most significant health issues in our world. So I have worked a bit on trying to get curriculum integrated into the medical student education at UCSF and also somewhat through my work with Climate Psychiatry Alliance. I want to say this case has been done by Carissa and Kayla. I came on late as an expert reviewer, but contributed to hoping to bring the case to life in regards to my expertise.
Great. Thank you all so much for sharing. It sounds like we have many needed perspectives on this case as we begin our discussions. So let's get started. We'll begin by reading out the initial patient presentation vignette, and then you all can walk us through how you'd investigate to build out your differential and reach a diagnosis. Cindy Clayton is a 36-year-old white woman who presents to the emergency department with complaints of shortness of breath and chest tightness. She feels that she's going to die. Additionally, she reports that her heart is racing, hands are shaking, and that she has a sensation that her fingers are tingling and she's sweating through her shirt. The patient indicates that her symptoms started when she was on her lunch break, and her attention was not focused on work tasks. Cindy has a history of asthma, and while her rescue inhaler slightly reduced her shortness of breath, it did not ameliorate any of her other symptoms. She also describes intrusive worries about impending doom from wildfires that catch her off guard and make it difficult for her to catch her breath. Upon further questioning, she reports that she has had similar episodes of varying severity almost daily for the last few months. Each time she experiences symptoms, her rescue inhaler does little to reduce them, which leaves her feeling helpless. Several of these episodes have been quite severe, resulting in other trips to the ED, the most recent of which was about a month ago. At each ED visit, Cindy's providers have determined that she is not having an asthma attack, and they have sent her home once her symptoms have abated. Any initial questions for Cindy's case?
So I would first ask, what are the pertinent review of systems?
Ms. Clayton presents as diaphoretic, tachycardic, and trembling. She endorses chills, tachypnea, chest tightness, stomach pain, nausea, weakness, dizziness, paresthesia of the upper extremities, anxiety, and insomnia. Her general review of systems is otherwise negative.
Before we go on, the last, when you've said she's already been to the emergency room several times and she's discharged when they determined that this is not an asthma attack, I think that's something that we need to underscore, think about. Why has this woman repeatedly come to the ED, and what is interfering with those people helping her to find a direction at this moment, even though they determine that this is not an asthma attack? I think this is something for us to consider about some of the failures of our health delivery in being able to pick up a great deal of distress and help this woman early on.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's an excellent point.
I'm going to add also, this is an issue of a provision of services and cost in the healthcare system. If we can intervene when this woman is having trouble early on, she may not cost as much with repeated emergency department visits.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Robin, I think you're hinting in this direction, so let's just ask it. I'm curious if Ms. Clayton has a psychiatric history, and has she had any animal exposure, sick contacts, recent travel history? What else do we know about her?
So Ms. Clayton denies periods of decreased need for sleep, excessive goal-directed activity, racing thoughts, auditory or visual hallucinations or delusions. She endorses hopelessness, difficulty falling and staying asleep, and low energy. She denies anhedonia, loss of appetite, and lack of concentration. She denies impulsivity or agitation. She endorses difficulty controlling her thoughts, restlessness, and muscle tension. When asked, she confirms shortness of breath, chest pain, sweating, numbness in the fingers, and tachycardia. She denies compulsions or phobias. She endorses a history of adverse childhood events and occasional nightmares. She denies suicidal ideation or a plan, and she confirms that she would ask for help if she were to start having thoughts about hurting herself. She denies any history of psychiatric hospitalizations, but notes that she was briefly seen by a psychiatrist when she was in her early 20s. He diagnosed her with PTSD, but she did not take any medications and did not follow up after a few appointments. She also notes that at the time she was drinking too much and occasionally using cocaine.
She has not used substances for the last 6 years.
So I'm glad that we know so much about her psychiatric history. I think that's going to be really helpful. One other area that we sometimes neglect in our assessment is environmental exposures. She mentioned concern about wildfire. Are there any other environmental exposures or other pertinent social history that we should be aware of?
Yeah. So Ms. Clayton grew up in Big Timber, Montana. She had three siblings. She reports a difficult upbringing due to food insecurity and physical abuse, both of which contributed to her PTSD. She started smoking cigarettes at age 14 and continued to smoke up to one pack per day until she was 30. She now smokes just every now and then, but mostly when she's juggling a lot. She grew up hunting and fishing with her father and grandfather, but she has been reluctant to engage in these activities recently due to her fear of being trapped by a wildfire or triggering an asthma attack.
So Dr. Cooper, I think that you're always good at reminding those of us who are still learners to think of the whole person. And this last bit of information, I think, really starts to peel back those layers. So I wonder if you have thoughts on that information.
Well, there are a number of things that strike me that are very interesting. I want to know a lot more about what this PTSD, what her post-traumatic stress disorder is. And we know that people with prior psychiatric difficulties are more vulnerable to triggering anxiety experiences when they present themselves in their lives now. Well, we know that she's had some physical abuse that may be a part of her childhood experiences, setting her in a situation of being quite vulnerable to what she's experiencing now. But I think it's incredibly interesting that we hear that she grew up hunting and fishing with her father and grandfather. Those have to be important experiences for her. I want to know what that connection to the outdoor environment is, how that connection with the outdoor environment is experienced with the relationships with her father and grandfather, and the meaning to that for her. I also am struck by her avoiding now these activities that have been very important to her. And I'm wondering and worried about whether some of the coping abilities and skills and places that she can retreat to for solace are no longer available because of her worries about wildfires. And I'm going to hold that in my mind about this patient. How can I maybe later think about engaging her with her relationship to the natural environment in a healthy way that helps her, not just scares her? I also want to know about whether she's actually experienced wildfires and the level of this in her life. So those are some of the ideas that are going on in my mind as I'm listening.
Thank you, Dr. Cooper, for those astute thoughts. And I think that sets us up well to start thinking more about this case with regards to a differential diagnosis. So just to summarize, this is a 36-year-old with a history of asthma and PTSD, presenting with shortness of breath, chest tightness, and tachycardia. So what are we thinking about the differential at this point?
At different stages in medical training, we are taught to be broad in our initial approach with our differential. So we don't want to miss certain things, both obvious and maybe more rare. So while she's been turned away from the hospital, she still could be experiencing asthma exacerbation. We also could be thinking of something like an allergic reaction. With COVID having been more current, she could be dealing with an infection that's more acute and impacting that shortness of breath. However, we don't want to miss psychiatric presentations like panic or anxiety. We do know that she has substance use history, so it's possible that that's something that she's relapsed and is using and impacting her presentation. She could be going through either exacerbation with a stimulant like meth or caffeine, or withdrawal from something like alcohol or benzodiazepine. She also could have had a toxin exposure or a CO2 poisoning, probably less likely. She could be dealing from some side effects of trauma and having something impacting her breathing like a spontaneous pneumothorax. And she also could be dealing with a metabolic acidosis. Some of those may seem less obvious. Given her age and despite her smoking history, COPD is less likely, but something we might think about for another patient when we're getting a shortness of breath presentation.
I want to go back to just the reminder at the beginning of the case that she doesn't have these symptoms when she focuses on her work. And it is more when she doesn't have that distraction that these kinds of troubles come up for her. So as important as it is to create the differential, it's also important to think, what's most likely? And maybe it's just because I'm the shrink in the room, but her anxiety just screams out to me.
Yeah, thank you for adding that point. I think there's a fine balance in medicine between wanting to be, like you said, very comprehensive and not missing really important things to consider, but also not losing sight of the bigger picture and recognizing that often your diagnosis is, you know, sometimes the more obvious thing. I will move on to physical exam findings, and after that, we can discuss and how that updates the differential at all. So her temperature, starting with her vital signs, her temperature was 37 degrees Celsius. Blood pressure was 135 over 90. Pulse was 95, and she was sitting 96% on room air. Overall, she was alert and oriented, well-appearing, slightly overweight female, taking rapid, shallow breaths and appearing mildly diaphoretic. On her head and neck exam, she was normal cephalic, pink conjunctiva, no jugular venous dissension or lymphadenopathy. On pulmonary exam, she was tachypneic, had faint inspiratory and expiratory wheezing, auscultated bilaterally, and there was use of accessory muscles. From a cardiac perspective, she had tachycardia, though a regular rhythm, normal S1 and S2 with no murmurs, rubs, or gallops. Her abdomen was soft and non-tender without organomegaly. Her extremities were warm, well-perfused, and without edema. There was no cyanosis or clubbing noted, and pulses were full and symmetric. From a psychiatric perspective, she denies harm to self or others, denies suicidal ideation. She was cooperative, though appeared frightened, with rapid, shallow breathing and trembling hands. Any updates to your differential after hearing this physical exam?
This isn't so much an update on the differential as one of the things I like to talk to my residents about is checking with the patient about what she thinks is going on, because her insight, she might well have an idea of what's happening. And sometimes somebody will present to the ER with a lot of symptoms and they'll get the whole medical workup when maybe the patient is thinking it's something more straightforward, but we forget to ask that.
So taking that into consideration, which is kind of the cornerstone of patient-centered care, and then reflecting back on her subjective presentation and now some of these objective findings, we can really confidently narrow the differential down and have a high suspicion for an underlying psychiatric driving cause like anxiety or panic.
And with that in mind, is there any additional laboratory workups that you would consider for this patient? For instance, if Ms. Clayton has been to the emergency department for tachypnea 3 to 4 times in the last year, would you consider a full cardiac workup? And then given that her symptoms didn't respond to her rescue inhaler, what, if anything, should be done to rule out an asthma attack?
So we were talking about this today, and unfortunately, or fortunately, we're maybe in a current climate of medicine where we sometimes practice defensively. And given she has gone to the emergency department multiple times and she hasn't gotten a clear diagnosis, we have the physical exam findings, but to be confident in our diagnosis, we're likely going to run some labs and do some additional interventions to be confident and make sure that we aren't missing something. Some of those labs and interventions we would consider would be a CBC, a CMP, a thyroid panel, an EKG, a UDS, and possibly some imaging with a chest X-ray.
Yeah, all great ideas. The lab results for Ms. Clayton showed that the CBC, CMP, and thyroid panels all were within normal limits. Her EKG was negative except for tachycardia. Her urine drug screen is also negative. At this point, how does this affect your differential, and what do you believe may be the most likely diagnosis at this point in the encounter?
So I think that we have enough information to confidently diagnose this patient with a panic disorder.
Or a panic attack. But that's a descriptive diagnosis. It doesn't tell us enough. We have to explore a bit more. A panic attack, or as we identify that, is, if we think of that, it's kind of like fever. When a panic attack occurs, they all look alike. Just like fever can be the presenting symptom or what we see, but it doesn't tell us the drivers of the feeling of the fever. What drives that to happen? It gives us a global sense. And that's true also as we identify for this woman that she's presenting and has repeatedly done so with panic attacks or anxiety. So it is now a time for us to think, what drives these panic attacks? Because that's going to be the thing that helps us to figure out how to help her.
Yes, so I think that brings us to a great point in our conversation to dive a little deeper and talk about this interface between psychiatric and other medical conditions and substance-related panic attacks. And so we've talked a little bit about the difference between panic disorder and panic attack. To start, how would you define a panic attack?
I think of a panic attack as it's an experience characterized by a sudden onset of intense fear or discomfort. It's usually accompanied by a range of physical and cognitive symptoms. I sometimes think of this as a shapeshifter. Anxiety can take so many forms. Those symptoms typically peak within a couple of minutes, and they can include anything from heart palpitations, sweating, trembling, sensations of shortness of breath, like our patient, smothering, chest pain or discomfort, nausea, abdominal distress, dizziness, lightheadedness, derealization or depersonalization, fear of losing control, fear of dying, numbness or tingling sensations, and even chills or hot flushes. So again, there's just so many different symptoms that can feed into this, but it's the constellation that's important. And as Robin was alluding to earlier, I think when we're thinking about panic disorder, it's when somebody's having repeated experiences of these panic attacks and starts to be afraid of having another one.
Thank you for clarifying that important difference between panic attack versus panic disorder. Are panic attacks related to other medical conditions or substances?
So they can absolutely be related or associated with various other psychiatric disorders. This can include generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, and depression. They can also occur as simply a symptom of other medical conditions, or they can be a byproduct of substance use, including substances like cocaine, amphetamines, nicotine, alcohol, even caffeine. They can also be correlating with withdrawal from substances like benzodiazepines or alcohol.
What are some other triggers of panic attacks?
If we look at this particular woman, we're talking about someone who we have identified as having panic attacks, repeated panic attacks. So she's probably in that realm of panic disorder that we've already talked about. And before I go on with that, I just want to give the sense that this is a profound experience of dread and sense that you may die. So this is an acute moment of that evokes profound sense of needing to flee or to experience themselves as dying, which is why they end up in the emergency room with worries about their own physical well-being. But we know that there may be some potential life experiences and triggers that evoke the moment of the panic attack. And that's separate from when panic attacks begin to be autonomous, when they come out of nowhere. And unless we treat panic attacks, we know that that can be something that progresses to more autonomous onset. But this woman has told us the experience and the memories and the thoughts about wildfires are particularly triggering to her. And we also know that she has this prior history of post-traumatic stress. We don't know a lot about that, but maybe these triggers now in her environment are something that evoke older kinds of experiences from her childhood of trauma that make her particularly vulnerable for the onset of these panic attacks. And now what we're seeing, panic disorder.
I want to piggyback on something you said, Robin, because I've certainly had learners say things like, oh, it was just a panic attack because it was maybe not a cardiac event. But these are some of the most uncomfortable experiences that people can have. And I think we do our patients a disservice when we suggest that they're just an anxiety experience.
Right. I thank you for that comment.
And to add to that, with a patient like this, where this isn't an isolated instance and there starts to be a pattern, we can start to see that it's incredibly functionally impairing and they are avoiding doing things in their lives, avoiding going places, things that they maybe previously enjoyed doing. We also find that both the triggers themselves can be very distressing, but the fact that these can happen without the presence of a trigger also adds to that sense of being so incredibly out of control and like your life is ending. So like Dr. Robum said, it's not just a panic attack. It's not just a panic disorder.
And it's a dismissal of the profound pain that mental suffering has when we say, oh, well, it's not a heart attack or something like that.
To kind of circle back a little bit to our case, how can traumatic events such as natural disasters play a role in the development of panic attacks or panic disorder?
I think it's not infrequent that traumatic events or experiences can trigger panic attacks for folks. And that can be anything from physical or sexual abuse to accidents, maybe witnessing violence, certainly experiencing a natural disaster or even anticipating one like a wildfire. That can elicit a panic attack in somebody who's predisposed or vulnerable. And I think people who have had traumas are probably at greater risk for future panic attacks, especially when those memories are triggered of their prior traumas.
In this day and age, where there are more and more climate change related disasters and events and experiences about the changing world that we live in, we cannot only look at those with pre-existing psychiatric disorders as the vulnerable populations. They are more vulnerable. They have particular kinds of histories that put them in that situation of greater vulnerability. But we are seeing great distress in large populations from both post-traumatic stress for those who have survived disasters or heat, but we're also seeing other kinds of anxiety disorders, particularly in youth who are very, very concerned about what they are experiencing and knowing about in our changing world that are due to climate. And those also have to be paid attention to.
I'll add a comment to that, Robin. I think sometimes when we think about these natural disasters, we fear everybody will have psychiatric complications. And the research actually suggests that at least half of folks will be remarkably resilient. But just given how much more frequently these disasters are occurring, we're going to see a higher prevalence of disorders. I heard an incredible stat the other day that said the U.S. experiences a $1 billion disaster. It used to be once every 4 months. Now it's once every 3 weeks. So again, we can just anticipate a much higher prevalence of these experiences for folks.
You are absolutely right that the data does indicate that those who have lived through disasters, and I'm talking now about climate-related disasters, but all disasters, most people don't end up with severe psychiatric disorders. But that is not uniform. And what the kinds of things that also make people more vulnerable to not being able to recover from disasters have to do with a wide range of things, some being prior psychiatric disorders, but social determinants of health, poverty, race, access to the capacity to have power and resources to recover both individually and communities have a large impact on the ability for people to recover from disasters. And then there's the other realm of anxiety disorders or worries or things that we're reading about in the press about eco-anxiety that don't rise to the level of what our patients experiencing, but are really important to think about on a public health level.
And so just want to underscore some of the very important things that we had just talked about. One, the importance of orienting towards the future and not just considering how these things are impacting us now, but how they can impact our communities as we look to the next decade, the next century. And then also that really strong connection between environmental changes and anxiety and panic disorders. And then third, what Robin was starting to get us into was how there's many additional risk factors, especially those social determinants of health, that make people more vulnerable to the climate change related challenges we see. And so in addition to the ones already discussed, are there any other populations that are more susceptible to mental health pathologies, both independent of and related to climate change?
I sometimes talk about climate change first responders. So examples I'll give are climate scientists or activists, folks who are spending a lot of time in this space and thinking a lot about climate change and its impacts. That can be really hard on the psyche unless people have support and are taking care of themselves, taking breaks. But I think Robin alluded to it. So our BIPOC communities, folks who have pre-existing chronic medical conditions are at greater risk for psychiatric challenges afterwards. Pregnant women, youth, the elderly, kind of our populations that are often at risk. And again, if they're not having adequate financial resources to buffer them, it makes sense that folks might be more likely to struggle in the aftermath.
I'm going to add one other group, although I agree with everything that Jen has said, but we don't tend to look at the mental health impacts for wildland firefighters. And our case here today is that her panic attacks and her anxiety are associated with the worries about wildfires. But we tend to think about wildland firefighters as heroes. But there's a lot of mental health toll that these heroes suffer. And we rarely think about that aspect of their work.
And I was wondering if any of you could speak a little bit more to how an environmental justice lens is so important when considering the impacts of climate change and how this case might have played out differently if the patient was of a different gender identity, a different race, a different social status, had a different education level, for example.
So something Dr. Robum had just said was that we know some of the most marginalized populations and communities end up being impacted first and maybe most severely by the impacts of climate change. We intentionally set this case in the West, not just because wildfires are prevalent there and have been for years. This is nothing new. I grew up in Montana and we used to joke about fire season, but because that they're very rural states largely, and those rural areas tend to have a dearth of resources and people and communities that have to do a lot with very little. And so interestingly, in terms of the point about environmental justice, there was a case just last summer in 2023 that was a landmark climate change trial held versus Montana. And a group of young people contended that the state of Montana's embrace of fossil fuels was destroying pristine environments. It was upending cultural traditions, and it was robbing the younger residents of a healthy future. And so the oldest plaintiff in that case, Ricky Held, was 18 at the time. She had grown up on a ranch in Broadus, Montana, not unlike Big Timber, where we set this case. And she had experienced unpredictable weather that had impacted her family as well as her livelihood. The youngest plaintiff was 2 years old. From Montana City. And this plaintiff had respiratory issues that was threatened by wildfires. So interestingly, this real life case in some ways paralleled this fictional case that we put together and really highlights how environmental justice is ultimately going to be part of the change that we hope to see when it comes to at least slowing down or turning back some of the impacts of climate change.
If I could just add to that, Carissa, you know, one thing I'd point out when we're thinking from a justice lens is the folks who are going to have the biggest physical and mental health impacts from climate change are going to be the folks who've contributed to it the least. And in the case of our youth, like the young people in the Held case, they will be living with the impacts the longest. So there's a lot of injustice when we're thinking about climate change and its health impacts. And in some ways, there's some moral injury involved as well, because at least for those of us in the global north, we're the reason this is happening, and we're struggling with that, its impact on our own psyches, sometimes in terms of feelings of guilt, like we're participating in this. But it doesn't mean anybody will be spared. So some folks will be at greater risk, but eventually we'll all be feeling the impacts.
And with that climate justice lens in mind, let's return to Mrs. Clayton. In terms of achieving our stated goals of relieving her suffering and providing a clearer diagnosis, what recommendations do you have for her treatment? And what does her prognosis look like?
I'd certainly want to refer her for some counseling or some outpatient therapy, in addition to any, I'll let the physicians in the room discuss the medication management, but I think some outpatient CBT could be helpful. Really, any mode of treatment could be helpful if it's moving beyond her panic. We have some good CBT treatments for panic disorder, and it'd be important to implement them. But I think any model that we follow, we'd want the person to be what we'd call climate aware or climate informed. And by that, I mean somebody who recognizes the impact of that climate change is having on people's psyches, and is able to talk about that with Ms. Clayton, both to not minimize her reactions and to help her think about what she can do in response to that.
So this patient hasn't taken any medication for her panic attacks or panic disorder. And so we'd want to have an informed consent conversation about that first line treatment, which is an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. There are multiple options. And if the patient hasn't taken one before, then we would look at what option may cover the majority of her symptoms. Sertraline is often an effective medication that's an SSRI because it can address the anxiety. It might also give her some relief from her PTSD symptoms. If the patient's taken an SSRI before and responded well to one, then we might consider that as a starting point. Some patients are interested in combining the medication with the therapy. Some want to do one first and then revisit. And all of those options are part of that informed consent conversation with the patient.
I could completely concur. I think it's incumbent on us to help control what has now become recurrent panic attacks. And that's a psychopharmacologic intervention. But I completely agree also with what Jen has put on the table. And I'm not going to just say, oh, we're only going to give you medicine, because we have a lot more tools in our tool bag. And those kinds of climate-informed therapists, as Jen has indicated, are going to be really important to her. But I also want to build on her strengths. So I'm going to look at her strengths to see if I can utilize some of those as she can become a part of helping herself. She likes to be outdoors. She likes to do physical activity. I'm going to talk with her about that. And then in addition to just to individual engagement in some therapies and some using her strengths and skills, I'm going to teach her about those calming ways of using breath to calm our nervous system. But I'm also going to want to see if I can engage her with social supports and group supports. Our individual treatments deprive our patients from being able to connect with others and see what they're going through as not alone, but are a part of things that many people experience. And I want to utilize that as a way to normalize some of her emotional responses and help her to be embedded with others in a helpful way.
I think often when we have conversations around climate change and its significant impacts, the conversations can easily start to feel like very hopeless and like nothing can be done. But I'm just wondering if any of you could speak to some things that a patient like Ms. Clayton can do to reduce her susceptibility to climate change and environmental exposures, and also to developing a disorder like panic disorder.
So when I walk through this case again, I actually see a lot of parallels to grief as well, which we didn't talk about in this case, but through a grief lens, there's really all the rules go out the window in a way. And yet we know that community can be such a strong support when we're facing this sense of hopelessness. And so having those times to connect individually with family, friends, but also with communities that may be sharing some of the same feelings or experiences. Interestingly, bringing people together doesn't amplify the pain necessarily. It can actually infuse some hope and some sense of belonging and purpose. So I think that that's another part of that toolkit, honestly, that we bring into the conversation to help support a patient like this.
Yeah, one thing I'd add to that is I think when we're talking about climate-aware psychotherapy or climate-informed, one of the central tenets that we talk about is helping folks to have a more of a sense of agency in the face of climate change, because that sense of powerlessness or hopelessness can be overpowering. And that jives, unfortunately, quite well with panic disorder. So one of the things that I would be thinking about with this patient is how can I support her in taking some kind of action that feels meaningful, and help her recognize that if lots of people are taking even tiny steps, that cumulatively that might make a real difference. And so I might talk to her about, yeah, who can you be talking to about climate change? Are there small political or collective action types of steps that you might take, something that helps you feel like there's something that you can do in the face of this? I think that can be very empowering.
So the supports that come from community engagement can also translate to real ways of involving oneself in community and in creating solutions. And there's nobody who can solve climate change in one fell swoop. It is the combination of the many doing small things. So when you say hopelessness, I say, no, there are things we can do.
That brings us to the end of this case. I want to thank you all for being so thoughtful in your care for Mrs. Clayton and how this connects to our communities. If each of you could leave listeners with one distilled lesson or takeaway today, what would that be?
I'll jump in first. You know, I think it's really important for any of our healthcare trainees to recognize that climate change is going to have lots of health impacts, both physical and mental. And that really needs to be on their radar when they're coming up with their differential diagnoses and assessing their patients. And something I like to say, especially as somebody who's maybe older than some of the trainees who are listening to your podcast, is I think for those of us who are in health education, it's really important for us to be preparing our trainees for the future, not the world we grew up in, but the one they're going to be practicing in. And that's going to be facing climate change.
So I'll be the broken record here, which I actually think is really important when we're talking about this topic. But climate change is real. It's happening now. It has far-reaching impacts on our environment, but also our health. And so engaging in our community is both protective against how we respond to the worrisome changes and the hopelessness we might experience, but it's also part of the solution for mitigating the future impacts of climate change.
Boy, I'm not sure I can add a whole lot there. Those are wonderful closing remarks. The only thing I would add, since we're talking about curriculum and education, is just the delving into the case study as we have done now can be a vehicle to open up a huge way of thinking, both about the patients that we care for, but about the broader issues that we're facing.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. Thank you again to Carissa Clarich, Dr. Jennifer Robom, and Dr. Robin Cooper, as well as Kayla Catley, who wasn't able to be here today, for talking with us about the connection between anxiety and climate change. If you want to read their case in full and take it to your own school's PBL sessions, you can find it on the Climate Resources for Health Education website at climatehealthed.org.
If you want to learn more about the ways climate change and health intersect and find out more ways you can get involved, check out Medical Students for a Sustainable Future and the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. If you want to write a problem-based learning case or a slide deck on a climate and health topic, visit climatehealthed.org to sign up. This is Elizabeth Whitten and Phoebe Cunningham signing off. See you next time.
This podcast is hosted by Phoebe Cunningham and Elizabeth Whitten and produced by Natasha Sid. This episode was sound edited by Leanna Hagas. This podcast series could not have been possible without support from Medical Students for a Sustainable Future and the Climate Clinic podcast at the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education.
And we also want to acknowledge the Indigenous lands that we're recording from. We are recording from Philadelphia, PA, which sits on the traditional homelands of the Lenape people. And lastly, we want to hear from you. Just send us an email at codegreenclimatepod@gmail.com or DM us on social media. Our Instagram is @codegreenclimatepod and our Twitter is @codegreenpod. And lastly, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this show.